You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. This is our special year-end extravaganza for 2016. It's been quite a year.
Worst year ever.
Yeah, I resisted that for a long time because I figured like people, you know, celebrities die all the time, but it really did add up to be in many other ways. Ways that were could have been foreseen and other ways it couldn't be foreseen, a pretty shitty year. So I don't know if you saw John Oliver's farewell to 2016. I share some of that. Of course, life goes on in our rest of our lives, but on the public stage and on our stages, there was a lot to talk about throughout American theater. So we're gonna look back on the year on stage and backstage, by which we mean not just the trade stories we might have written about, but also backstage here at American Theater, the exciting things that go on here, because I know you all want to know about that. And then we're going to look, just sort of recount some of the highlights of the year and the arc of the year, again, both on stage and off. And then we have an interview with Chris Vier of Time Out Chicago, the chief critic there, to fill us in a little bit about shows he likes there, but also about some of the drama going on with the neo-futurists, which is a story we have not reported on, but we've been following, and we'll hear what Chris has to say. So let me introduce who's here. Across the table from me, an infrequent guest on the podcast.
But I'm coming by more often.
Yes.
Russ Denman, managing editor.
Great.
Allison Considine, the staff writer.
Adeep Tran, associate editor.
And Susie Evans, senior editor.
And I don't think I said I'm Rob Weinert-Kant, the editor-in-chief. I forget to do the introductions. We assume that you know I'm the first voice you usually hear on the show.
Our fearless leader.
Fearless, yeah.
Some guy.
So, in any case, we were going to go around and talk about I think we're just going to start with like our favorite show. Like, just what show do we like the best from this year? And I'm just going to do a lightning round. Go to you, Allison, and surprise you.
All right. I have a few written down, but...
A few? No, you can do as many as you want.
I think I'm going to go with The Humans. Floor.
The Humans. Oh, you know, nice.
Coming from Scranton. Mm. Irish. Raised in a Catholic family. I felt a lot with The Humans. I also really liked Hadestown. I saw it in July, and I sing the songs probably twice a week. They're always stuck in my head. Most recently, Sarah Dunlap's The Wolves at Playwrights Realm was pretty fantastic.
All fine choices, and did a podcast, our last podcast, or two podcasts ago, was with Sarah Dunlap, and of course, mm-hmm. The Humans, yeah, that's a fine show. I saw it on Broadway?
Yes.
Yeah. I saw it when it was around about a couple, like a year and a half ago, but I guess it's going to close January, is that
January
right?
January closing, yeah.
It's going on tour, though.
It's a hopeful sign that a play like that, you know, their play makes it to a new play by a playwright who's not been on Broadway before and who most laymen doesn't know that it got as much of a splash. I would hear it advertised actually on podcasts and on the radio, an actual Broadway play.
Yeah, on a Keeping It 1600 podcast. It's brought to you by The Humans.
Exactly.
Playing on Broadway.
Mark Maron talked to Stephen Karam on his show. Anyway, yeah, big fan of that show. And then Deep, tell one of your favorites.
Okay. I wanted to say Viet Gone again because that was what I said on the Maximu podcast, but then I realized I said it here last year that it was the best show for me last year, so I should not repeat on this podcast. So mine is, well, I've been just really in a political theater kick lately just because of...
Why would that be?
Yeah, what happened? And a lot that ruined, like the rest of what was a really good year for me. So my favorite shows this year were Sweat by Lynn Nottage, Notes, which is coming on Broadway in April.
Around
April.
In the spring.
Lynn Nottage's much belated Broadway debut. I'm very excited for her and for this play, which is also set in Pennsylvania. Allison's favorite state. Yay! Representing in the theater. And then I really loved Notes from the Field by Anne DeVere Smith. I saw a second stage, and I've never seen her, like, besides at the TCG conference, I'd never seen her do a one-person show before. And I really do not like one-person shows most of the time, but Oh my God.
Her shows are really multi-person shows in a way.
Very multi-person. She and not in fact, there's multiple voices, but it's just like she just gets so, she's such a talented interviewer. And like she gets like these really beautiful poetic chunks of dialogue out of people. And I'm just thinking, wait, how do you do that? I need to learn how to do that. And maybe people can give me better quotes.
Yeah, she's special.
Yeah, and then the other one was Taylor Mack related, but that's my next. That's gonna be
the moment. I'm gonna just surprise you. Go to you, Russ. Jumping around the circle in a funny way. All right,
sure. So I have some favorite shows, but also a favorite moment related to the theater that is not a stage production. So I'll start there.
Start
where you want. Isn't that our next topic?
That's our next topic.
Oh, okay.
We're gonna do favorite theater moments next. Could be one of our favorite shows. So. We're looking for titles for the first one. Don't worry, there's no rules. You can say whatever you want.
All right, I'll do shows now. I'm a big rule guy. So for my shows, Party People at the Public Theater, created by Universes. It was particularly powerful. Sorry for all the P's.
I hate you.
It was especially impactful because
now you're just trying.
Well, that's the idea. Yes, it had a lot of a resonance to it because I caught it 3 days after the election, so there were a lot of different feelings in the room, and for that audience that night, it was a really special performance. If you don't know, the piece is about the Black Panther Party and a reunion of former members, and it mixes media, and it's a really engaging theatrical event, and it's just a really great piece of theater. Also, I caught Seven Guitars at Yale Rep, which was also a really strong performance, and not an August Wilson play that you see that frequently, and just another great representation of a fantastic voice of the American theater. And just,
who's the director on that one? Do you remember?
I don't.
Yeah, I don't know. He's done it so frequently. I didn't keep track of that one.
Yeah. And also, Deep didn't say it, so I will. Viet Gone was another favorite performance of mine. Am I taking all yours?
Rob's going to say it.
It's okay.
Rob has nothing left to say.
It's
He's
right.
done.
Yeah, I don't have to say anything. No, go on.
So those are my shows.
That's awesome. Susie?
Like Allison, I too had The Wolves on my list of favorite shows of the year. I saw it for the first time at New York Stage and Film at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, and that's kind of where it blew my mind, but I also loved it at the Playwrights Realm here in New York. Another favorite was Tracy Letts, Mary Page Marlowe at Steppenwolf, which is hopefully coming to New York sometime. Nothing is announced, but it's Tracy Letts. And that was just kind of an amazing ensemble piece where like seven actors played the main character, and beautifully directed by Andy Shapiro.
Published by TCG Books.
Yep. A really cool theater experience. And I'm going to choose this one for my favorite show and not for my experience. I got to see the Taylor Mack 24 decade history of popular music, and it's very hard to pick one moment. So I'm just going to say that whole experience was top of the year.
All the hours. Your trip around the sun. Actually, not your trip around the sun.
Yeah, because apparently we suck at science, Rob.
My lead. It's not a trip around the sun?
It was a great headline. I didn't even fix it. No, a trip around the sun would be a year.
Oh. Well, it felt like a year.
I don't know. I couldn't figure out how to fix it. Like a trip, the sun, the earth going around once. I got a rotation.
A rotation around the sun.
Not even around the sun.
We don't go around the sun in one day. It goes up and it comes down and it comes back up again.
Wow. Someone failed.
I'm a writer.
Deep, you're about to say biology.
It looks like the sun. It looks like the sun goes around, but it's actually,
So what do we go around then?
We do go around the sun, but
we rotate. We don't revolve every day.
You know this.
Yeah. No. No, I'm learning new things today.
No, the earth turns, Susie.
Production of Galileo is needed now.
That's the only way we learn things, if it's on
stage. Is it in the theater? Did they explain this in a play?
Anyway, I took a trip around the sun with Taylor Mack, and I'm sticking to that lead.
That's great. Well, he did many trips around the sun to get
there
it done.
There you go. The show was a lot of years.
Yeah, it took a lot of years in the making. So
and
there you
it
go.
Channeled a lot of years.
That's true.
250 trips around the
250
sun.
250 years of American history and American popular music.
220.
No, 24.
224. 24 decades. 24 decades. 240.
240.
Yeah, 24 decades.
Okay, we can do math. That's great.
All right, okay, we got science, we got math. We're learning it all here on this podcast.
So, yeah, you get to me and you guys are taking all mine. No, I would say Vietnam was the show of the year. I mean, just if we've talked about it before on the podcast. It's been talked about a lot.
We're printing it.
We're publishing it in February. You know, I like this. I wouldn't like every play to be like Vietcong, but I wish more plays were like Vietcong. That were as just aesthetically, you know, as playful and yet serious. That were cast as well and designed as well, and just were as much fun, but also had a lot to say. So I would love more theater like that. Because we all love fun theater. We all love theater that's heavy, hard hitting, but not too much theater has both. Mm-hmm. The other ones I would just cite really quickly are sort of pairs. I think of them as pairs. The two Danai Gurira plays this year could not be more different. I mean, you could walk while they were running at the same time. Eclipse was on Broadway. Familiar with the Playwrights Horizons. You could walk from one to the other. You would not. If you didn't look at the playbill, I'm not sure you would know it was the same writer. Such different plays. A sort of a family farce, and somehow making a family farce about a wedding fresh and moving and interesting was great. And then Eclipse, of course, which was a wonderful drama. Mm-hmm. So you know. She's a writer. It would be the emergence of a great American playwright. We published her before. She's been around a while, but this seems like a real arrival. And of course, Deep did a wonderful, probably the most beautiful cover, I will say, that we've ever run, our February.
Well,
issue.
It's not that difficult. Because well, she is a beautiful
subject,
person.
Yes,
so
exactly. Well, then we just put it on the cover. But no, there was a lot of effort that went into it. It looked great. The other one I think of as a pair, I think I saw them around the same time. It's not maybe fair to pair them, but Jacqueline Backhouse's Men in Boats had a return run at space at Playwrights.
Yeah,
and,
Club Dumb Production.
I saw around the same time I saw The Wolves, and I just thought this is just amazing. Just like two plays with a huge ensemble cast of women. You know, I had a great time at both. Very different plays. Very, needless to say, one being a historical drama about the Grand Canyon and about men, in which there were no actual men in it, and no boats really, although boats represented. And then The Wolves, the play about the girls' soccer team. The last one I would say is that closing out the year on a really strong note was this Othello at New York Theater Workshop.
Wow, you got in?
Yeah, no, it's
well, you know,
he wrote the piece on it.
Editor in chief of American Theater. Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I think I wrote the piece mainly so I could get it.
That's how we cover shows here, folks.
Andrew Lieberman is the scenic designer who's worked a lot with Sam Gold. I was very struck by their look back in anger at Roundabout, where they basically sealed off the stage and people had, like, it was like there was no proscenium, which was a really bold choice, kind of aggressive. I was not a fan. I was one of the few people who did not like their Vanya at Soho Rep. It really was uncomfortable seating and some great actors, but it bored me. But this was a real arrival. I mean, it goes without saying it's a great play, but I've seen, you know, it's easy to mess up Shakespeare, and they didn't in this case. It's really, it may be just short of great, but it's a really wonderful production, worth seeing if you can. Is it going to run for a while? I can imagine going
January.
Through January. Totally
sold out.
I
was thinking,
ticket.
Could this go to Broadway? The problem is it's so much about the space. I don't know how they would do it. Even at like Circle in the Square.
Circle in the Square, maybe. Yeah, because that's a small house.
No, but
right?
It's not.
Or the house where the Lyric, is it the one that had Next to Normal in it, the really small house?
No, yeah, the Lyric is the huge one that had Spider-Man in it.
Oh, sorry. I think I don't remember.
It's tough even with a big Broadway run to get those stars to commit. Anyway, it's
The booth had a wonderful production.
Yeah, the booth. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
next one.
And you can also look in our January issue. It'll probably be up online soon. Mm-hmm. A wonderful look at the history of Othello in the U.S., which is as thorny and as complicated as you might expect. And it's a really good piece by Andrew Carlson.
Oh, and I just and I want to add that some of the shows you recommended are actually playing or will be playing. Viet Gon's playing at Seattle Rep now, but it's entirely sold out. But if you can get tickets, it's a great time. Men on Boats is playing at American Repertory
Theater Company.
American Theater Company in Chicago.
Right.
So it's
what else? The Wolves is
playing
right
closes
now.
December 29th.
An HBO
29th.
Movie anytime soon. No, I don't know.
It's still running. It runs through December 29th.
I can't imagine a familiar will not get done. other places.
Yeah.
It's a pretty large cast, and it's mostly African American, but that would not be the hard.
And Taylor Mack is still sleeping it off.
Yes. He's no longer on Facebook. I'm so sad.
He's hibernating.
Yeah.
Othello might come to a theater near you too, but not in this production. Anyway, so let's talk about
Othello,
favorite
Rob?
Theater moments. Russ, you were very eager to talk about it, so why don't you start us off? I'm just going to mix up the order.
Yes.
Moments.
Moment, Lin-Manuel Miranda hosting Saturday Night Live, mm-hmm. which as far as we know is the first time that a person primarily known as a theater artist has hosted SNL.
Seriously?
It seems to be the case.
Someone did the research on that?
Well, Brian Herrera says it is.
What so. Someone fact check this.
Andrew Lloyd Webber never did it? No, just kidding.
Yeah, right?
Sondheim?
No.
That's probably true. Mm-hmm. I think we take for granted about how much that's crossed over into the mainstream. It's like, not since ever, really. Not right. since the 50s where, you know, were the people doing Broadway shows the ones that you saw on Ed Sullivan, the ones that you saw on TV. Yeah, yeah.
It's not like Carol Channing ever hosted SNL or anything, right?
Julie
it's
Andrews?
A lost episode.
Right.
Any of our divas?
What's that?
Patti LuPone?
Any of our divas?
Nope.
Maybe? No?
It's
no?
very unlikely. I mean, wouldn't Laura Benanti be great on that show?
She'd be excellent.
But, Melania Trump. I think she's bringing it back, though, that impression.
Yeah, yeah.
She's having a baby Lin-Manuel in like a month, so.
You know, I was thinking about that because that was right after the pussy grab weekend, yep. right? And that was the, sorry, that sounds crass to say it that way, but he had the whole riff on You're Never Going to Be President.
Yes, he did.
Which seemed so obvious at the time. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, but of course that episode had classic moments like Crucible Cast Party.
That is the classic moment, I think. That was genius.
No, Benjamin episode. And Larry O'Keefe went as Crucible Cast Party for Halloween.
Oh, that's amazing.
How do you go as that?
I don't know how they went
as
out
characters
that, but
from
that
it.
Was like my small talk leading into my like interview with Elle. She's like, oh, this is what we went as.
That's awesome. Is that your moment? That's good.
That's
a good
moment.
Allison?
So my favorite theater moment, which I interpreted this question a little differently. I traveled to Salt Lake City earlier this year to write about climbing with tigers at Salt Lake Acting Company, which is a play that was adapted from a book written by a 9-year-old boy who has brittle bones disease. And the play follows a little blackbird who has brittle bones and wants to learn how to fly. So I think one of my favorite moments this year was getting to watch Nathan Glad go down the red carpet and just seeing this whole creative team come together to tell this little boy's story. So it was like pure theater magic moment.
There's a photo of that moment in your piece, isn't there?
There is, yes. There's a photo of him coming down in his tuxedo on the red carpet.
That's amazing.
And the back of your head interviewing him, right?
The back of my head. I did. I made an appearance in American Theater
Magazine. Oh, such a great story, Allison. Thank you for reminding me of that story.
We run so
reading
much.
That story was a great moment this year. Susie.
My two has to do with the omnipresent Lin-Manuel Miranda. So,
all right, that's
I
okay.
thought we were over Hamilton, but I guess we're not.
I
got to see. Well, we just had a rule on this podcast for a while. We weren't allowed to talk about
it. No, Hamilton. So I went to
Chicago to see the Chicago cast of Hamilton the weekend after the election.
Okay,
it was like 3 days after. And there was, you know, lots of talk of things that happened in the theater after the Hamilton election with them addressing Mike Pence and seeing the show and the Trump supporter kind of getting kicked out of the Chicago theater. I wasn't at that performance, but the response to the show in that political climate was extremely different. Like that was Don't Hate Me podcast listeners. That was my sixth time seeing the show.
Right.
And it was like totally different. The people in this room hate me now. So okay, great. But they're like response to like immigrants, we get the job done. It like stopped the show in a different way.
Okay,
it was like a totally different way of experiencing that show, and it's kind of a singular experience.
And the cast was good. I don't know. We talked about this already on the podcast.
Yeah, the cast was good. I saw the Hamilton alternate. Miguel Cervantes, I think is how you say his name, plays Hamilton in Chicago. But there's an actor named Joseph Morales who does it once a week, and he happened to be performing the show I saw, and he was incredible. And of course, Josh Henry and Karen Olivo are amazing as Angelica and Burr.
Yeah.
Other way, Josh plays Burr and Karen plays.
Oh, I want to see him
Angelica.
Switch.
I love the guy who played Washington, Christopher Kincaid. He was incredible. Anyway, it's a good cast, but watching it after the election was insane.
So, what's your other Lin? You had another Lin one?
No, no, that's just Lin.
Oh, I thought you said you had two.
Well, second to Russ's had one.
Oh, I'm sorry. The second reference. Yeah, yeah.
Do you want me to think of another Lin one?
No, no, that's fine. That's fine.
Oh, wait, I do have one.
Well, okay. I asked for it. I get it.
I got to go to the Hamilton Tony Awards party.
Oh, my
and
God.
And Lin and Questlove DJ'd. And watching Lin geek out in the DJ booth at 4 a.m. was kind of a highlight.
So you didn't even talk about the Hamilton mixtape concert you got to go to, right?
Oh, yeah. We went to that, too.
That was
he wasn't there Allison though. Lin wasn't there. Well,
he videoed in from London.
Were. Other stars were, I'm sure. Deep, I know you got to go to a breakfast at which he was there for the Soul Project.
So yeah,
we all had our Lin-Manuel signings this year, except for Russ and me.
I think Russ is the only one who hasn't seen Hamilton, so that's why he's really sad.
We're
going to
take up a collection for you, Russ.
Well, because the story is that I fact checked Susie's piece.
Yeah,
my first task here at American Theater, and so at this point, I'm now the only one on staff who has not seen the show.
Russ, we will set that right. That'll be New Year's resolution for 2017.
I appreciate that.
Maybe will Spamilton do? No,
sure.
I don't know if he'll get Spamilton if he hasn't seen.
So, Deep, a favorite moment. I think you're about to talk about it.
Oh right, yeah. Taylor, picking back on Susie, it's Taylor Mac related. And specifically, so I took my sister to the segment of the 24 Decade concert that was from 1956 to 1986. Is that the right time span? 30 years?
Yeah, that's right.
That's 30.
It's 86 to 2016.
Yeah, this was the concert where Taylor sang David Bowie's Heroes and Prince's Purple Rain. Awesome, awesome evening. So I took my sister, who looks like me, basically. And she doesn't go to the theater a lot. And then so we're sitting in the back because it's open seating. And it wasn't a very good view. And then Taylor comes out and says, "We're going to recreate White Flight." So the critics were sitting in the middle and they were partitioned off. And what Taylor said basically was, "Okay, everyone, all the white people sitting in the middle of the theater, get up and walk out and move to the edges. And all the people of color come in and sit in the center." Because the center is a city and the outside are the suburbs. So it's White Flight. So basically, I got a free upgrade because I was Asian, which never happens. So,
did you have the experience of there being like no one sitting in the middle?
Yes.
That's what it was like when they did it for us. I like had two people on my lap.
Wow.
It was amazing. And Isherwood was there and he was just standing. Charles Isherwood was there and he was just saying very awkwardly.
Wait, he's white?
Side.
No.
Just he did joke. Put the show on his like top 10 of the year, though.
Oh, oh no, yeah, he went to so many of them.
Well, actually, no, you know, he didn't go to all of it. He went to some of them, right?
He went to 18 hours of the 24.
Yeah, Wesley Morris wrote the piece for the Times.
But yeah, my sister loved it, and she was pretty drunk, so that made it so much better.
I think that was my favorite section.
Yeah, same.
That's awesome. Well, this year I took my sons to three different circuses, including Cirque du Soleil's Curios, the Big Apple Circus, and the Universal Circus. But those aren't the moments I want to talk about. I just wanted to drop that in there. They didn't see a lot of theater this year. The New Victory only had one show that I was able to get them to, a French show called Cité. But I would say the moment I had that was most theatrical moment was I went to see Richard II at BAM. It was the thing that came from the RSC. And it was a pretty dramatic scene early on when Hotspur, played by Jasper Britton, this wonderful, jowly British actor. Not particularly old, but he was playing sort of a jowly, like, stern character. He's giving a talking to his men, and we were in the Harvey Theater fairly close up. I was sitting with Jason Zinnemann, and Jason Zinnemann sneezed. Not particularly, like, super loud, but, you know, he sneezed. And Jasper Britton, without breaking, you know, he said, "Bless you." Like in the middle of the Shakespearean line, just did it. And like, it got a little chuckle, but he didn't break character at all. And then just as the scene was over, he like shot a look back at Jason, like, "Got my eye on you." It was totally in character and it totally fit the play. I don't know if
Did I ever tell you about the time I saw Mark Rylance do Richard III and a woman literally passed out in an onstage seat while he was in the middle of the monologue and he made sure she was okay in character?
Wow. The Brits
it was
found.
Ridiculous.
Did they just leave her there? Like, what
no,
happened?
No, no, no. It was to the side, and he like went and made sure she was okay. People took her off stage, and she woke up. She's fine.
Okay,
but
just
he like
sure
he attended to it completely in character.
They're, you know, the Brits are ready for anything. I think
we call him a Brit, but we did publish a story. Mark Rylance, American.
Well, actually, yeah,
he's a little bit from Minneapolis.
He's a little bit country, a little bit rock. He's both. We're going to now go talk about just a look back at the year, even though we just talked about some of our highlights. You know, this was the year of the TCG conference in D.C., which was a very impactful conference. Samantha Power was a guest at the final plenary with Oscar Eustace. That was fascinating to talk about. Their dialogue that they've had over the years, and of course the big story people took away was the time she talked about taking was it not the UN Security Council, that was something else, but it was a group, a human rights, was it?
I don't remember what group it was exactly, but it contained a bunch of countries that had really restrictive LGBTQ laws.
She took him to see Fun Home.
And she did.
With comps from Oscar. And
she called it soft power. He's her soft power projectile.
Yeah. And she felt like it led to softening of hardened positions against gay rights in some of those countries. And she's just an awesome individual, would be sad to see her go. It was also the occasion in which Mike Daisy was trying out his show, The Trump Card, which was his one-man show about Donald Trump. Not as Donald Trump. We had the idea to cast him as Donald Trump for an image we shot there in D.C.
Another good moment, actually, that I remember. Okay.
Yeah.
So about that Mike Daisy photo shoot.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah. The photo shoot.
So
yeah.
We're taking the photo in outside of the Folger Theater, and it's because the Folger Theater is next to the Capitol building.
Right.
And so he's in the Capitol building's in the background. You know, we're standing in the street. We're taking his photo.
He's all dressed up like Trump with the makeup and the hair and the
and,
suit.
Yep, and the eyebrows even. Like, they did a great job. I think it was Shakespeare Theater who did the makeup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was the costume and makeup people from Shakespeare Theater. Makeup and hair.
And then he's posing as Donald Trump, and then this car drives past very slowly, and the guy yells out the window, "I hope you have a heart attack and die."
Yeah.
And even though from a distance he might kind of can look like Donald Trump, but you know it's not. And
no.
So it was just like one of those a lot of aggression.
He turned that into a moment in the show, which I saw, I think, the same night. At William Mammoth, he was trying out the show, and he talked about that in terms of the way as a mutually mediated moment where he's pretending to be Trump, and this guy is pretending to tell Trump, because it's meant for Trump. And Mike also took the, because he's a large man, and I feel like he is very aware of fat bias, anti-fat bias, and people just saying, he's had a lot of trolls and haters say that to him, like, "I hope you have a heart attack and die." So he did take it personally, but he also saw that person was trying to talk through him to Trump in a way. And anyway, it's a fascinating piece. I do remember the feeling in that room that he created, where it was mostly liberal theater people sort of going, we can't take this guy seriously, but he was telling us to take Not the chances that Trump would win seriously, which he was still before the Republican convention, but the chances the way in which he had what he exposed about our democracy, our country, our discourse. His closing thought, I think, and I put this in my January editorial in the magazine, is that even if Trump hadn't won, he'd still won in a way. He had arrested our attention away from important things and lowered our discourse in important ways, and he continues to do so. I mean, I think I could say so.
Is that a trend for this year? Theater people talking a lot about politics, or politics infiltrating theater?
Well, it's an election year, so
yeah.
We already were on top of that with we did coverage of that. It was on people's minds, obviously, this year. In an election year, it's always a political year. I don't think, as we all know, the issues raised by the election were not put to bed by the election, and we will be dealing with them in our work and in our lives and on stages and in our lobbies for a long time.
And as a number of people said in our post-election colloquy,
yes,
theater is always political. It just happens to be that the nature of that political quality has taken a slightly different turn at this point in our history.
Yeah, look, after 9/11, everything looked different. Everything felt different. Even the light stuff felt maybe too light or had new resonances. That's definitely the case now, even for shows that weren't intended, to have that resonance, they do. Including, Party People you know, was made years ago.
But the night I saw it, they did say in the middle of one line, that's why Donald Trump is president.
Yep.
Well,
yep.
Yeah, it's yep. that's also the kind of show that they can add things to, right?
Right. And then I think after like every performance after post-election, they've been doing like talkbacks of people who can just, you know,
process,
talk about how they feel, vent some frustrations at why we are the way that we are. Mm. Anyhow, how do we get into this topic, Rob?
Well, we're looking back on the year. We could talk about maybe some of the favorite things that we worked on and put in the magazine, maybe. October issue is always a big one. I was extremely happy with that package with the Mac Wellman interview and then Helen Shaw's piece about the state of the play.
So good. So
good. It was
good.
So good. It's like one of my favorite things I've read in 10 years, let alone had the privilege to publish. So that's really worth looking at. I would say one of my favorite online pieces this year was Deep's piece about overtime. Which was part of a learning process, actually. We first did a piece, a sort of FAQ about the new overtime laws, written very much from a management point of view, it was taken as if we were telling people how to get around the laws, which was not the intention. So we sort of went back to the drawing board and did another even better story that, I mean, it was as good as anything we put in print about the impact, the ramifications, the anxieties on both sides about what the new overtime law would and would not mean. It was a great piece.
Yeah. Kind of sad longer applicable, but
it might not be applicable. Although as we have a February issue I'm teasing now about artist compensation, it has prompted some organizations, I'm sure not just in the arts, to step up.
Pay
people
better.
Better, hopefully. So those are the stories I could talk about. There's a pile of wonderful issues here next to me. It was I'm proud of this year. Anyone else want to talk about a favorite story or issue or thing?
I loved Deep's Denai Guerrero piece.
Wow, it's all about Deep.
Oh,
and in terms of favorite moment working on something, I really enjoyed the reporting for my Ghost Stories piece where...
Oh, that was fun. That was a fun piece.
That was fun. Just people telling me their stories and saying, I don't believe in ghosts, but I have no way to explain what happened.
So this is an online piece you did around Halloween about people, theater ghosts.
Yep, and I'm working on round two with
who knew there was such a thing as theater ghosts? No, it's obviously it's a big deal. And working on round two, really?
Yep.
Yeah, we just tip of the iceberg on that one.
Yeah, the theater ghost beat. We're on the theater ghost beat.
Other favorites this year?
I didn't write a whole bunch this year. I had fun editing the politics issue.
That was a good issue. That Michelle Valensky piece and the Mike Daisy piece. Michelle Valensky, the dramaturg, went around to various went to rallies of almost all the candidates during the primaries.
I guess my piece on I didn't write it report it this year, but it might came out this year with Tracy Letts and Annity Shapiro getting to talk to them about their partnership was really cool. That was a fun thing to do. I learned that Tracy Letts had never met Anna, and he and his friends went and just knocked on her door and were like, will you direct our play, when they were like all in college. Great stories.
Mine is also from the October issue. One of my favorite trips and favorite things I got to work on this year was putting together the production notebook for the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. So it was cool to get to follow the five different plays and their creative teams and see how they put a big festival together that's all in rotating repertory.
We've had some really good production notebook pieces this year, when you first proposed it, I was just like, who the hell wants to read about how
shows are put together?
Yeah. Yeah. Even though it's well within our purview, but then at the same time, like there's just like certain show concepts where I was like, wait, what, why?
Yeah.
Why? But that one in particular was like really good, Allison. Just in terms of just like the scope, and it's not something people do a lot now. And so just like getting the inside look at how you manage five shows at once is just like fascinating.
And if you aren't aware, Production Notebook used to be the name for our two-page spread that printed a glorious photo of a production and had excerpts of quotes from one or more individuals from the creative team discussing their work putting together the production.
Yeah, and intended to focus on design, visual design, because that was the layout. Yep. And I thought we should
not so much sound design in that feature.
I mean, we've been doing it for almost 2 years now, right?
It's only been about a year.
December 2015 was the first.
Really?
And so
I think it was November 2015.
No, it was December.
It was
Barry Wisdom.
Mr. Burns, the late Barry Wisdom. Yeah.
Who did our first one, and also shot the cover photo.
I just thought let's make it an actual production notebook. We it's the kind of story we've done over the years. You know, we glancingly find out about that happened backstage. You were arguing about that. We can't. We're usually profiling an actor or a playwright or whatever. We'll hear bits of stories about a production. We thought let's take an interesting production each month around the country from different places. In the case of that great Contemporary American Theater Festival, we thought let's take a. They're basically producing all at once. Five plays, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Five plays in rep.
So plays in rep. And we thought that's a way to talk about like a five play production effort all at once. So, and that was your second year going there. Is that right?
Yes, that was my second summer.
You're on the beat there.
And so I take credit for sending you there the first time.
I know. Deep couldn't go, so I do have a favorite.
So yes. When I'm at the theater, I watch television. So the February issue was just the rare time where the things I love outside of theater actually interact with theater in general.
Theme, right.
I love that issue, the February issue to Nigerera, and the that was a really great interview to do. And then like the story about TV, like the playwrights writing about TV, which was one that I've been wanting us to run for such a long time.
Yeah, Jay Holtham's piece was great.
Happened. That was good.
Yeah. And Susie got to do a story I really wanted to do.
Ha ha ha.
It's like on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend for online because it's both of our, you know, favorite shows of the moment. And she opened it up with an amazing anecdote about how the creators come into the writing room singing Hamilton. Sisters, yeah.
I got picked up on Fun Girls for that. And we got so much traffic. I was excited. But that's that brings true. Me back. I was gonna be my other moment, which I'm gonna use because it's a tie-in. I got to see the Crazy Ex-Girlfriend live concert at 54 Below.
Wow!
And seeing Rachel Bloom sing "You Stupid Bitch" like live, and then climb on top of a piano with Adam Schlesinger was just.
It's when
priceless.
you sort of bookend the year with two theater TV theme pieces. Your other piece with Bob Greenblatt you just did.
Yeah, I love TV too, like deep.
It's going to be in our January issue, but we already put it online because he was behind the.
Yeah, I did a big interview with the chairman of entertainment at NBC, Bob Greenblatt, who's also a big theater producer. He helps run Universal Theatricals.
And he's partly behind Dear Evan Hansen, is that
yeah,
right?
He's he's an investor and a producer. He's not like Stacey Mindich is the lead producer. I know it would have been my top show, but I saw it last year, so I can't use it again.
I would not put it at the very top, but it's very strong.
Did you see it?
Very strong, yeah, yeah. No, I really liked it. It's
Dear Evan Hansen,
right?
Yeah.
Of course I cried. I sat next to you. Did you cry, Rob?
Did Rob cry?
That's the question. A little bit. With the mom.
The mom song.
The guy annoyed me by the end, and he never got his right comeuppance.
Like. Hilton Al said that. You actually agree with him on something.
I know. That was actually a really good piece by Hilton, I got to say.
You didn't like Ben Platt?
No, I love Ben Platt. I love Ben Platt, but just to
the character.
My thumbnail is that like they build all that suspense up, and then he just like...
He gets off. He gets off easy. He doesn't learn anything.
He didn't go to school. He took a year off.
Yeah, that's
rough. He worked at Pottery Barn.
Had to work at Pottery Barn.
Working at Pottery Barn is not great punishment for all that he did. Anyway, no, it's beautifully done. It's beautifully done.
Now we've spoiled the show for you.
I was going to say production. We had a lot of great covers this year. Danai Gurira, Zelda for Chandler. The one with the guy with the spike in his head from Nola Project.
November.
Beautiful Chris Acebo cover for the political issue where he designed a set of a rally stage, and we shot the maquette. I love that. But I just want to single out. I know you didn't write this, Susie, but you were sort of behind this Tara Johnson's piece.
I didn't write it, but I edited it and put it together
for Peter Pan on our 70th
birthday.
Did
a lot of editing this year.
The Sarah play. Mm-hmm. I'm just moved that we put Kathleen Chalfant flying on our cover.
Yeah.
She's known still for Angels in America, but she did not fly in that play. But she flew on our cover. She flew in this
She did fly in this play. This is her picture of Kathleen Chalfant at
company.
It's not at Actors Theater. It's at ZFX, Flying FX.
Oh, wait, where they were doing that.
And I'm going to add to that another favorite piece of the year is we have a piece of Sarah Ruhl interviewing her mom.
That was so awesome.
Because that play is inspired by Sarah Ruhl's mom starring as Peter Pan. And she wrote it for her mom. And her mom will be playing the role Kathleen Chalfant played at Actors Theater in Chicago, in a production directed by Jessica Thebus, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we have a nice interview with Sarah interviewing her mom about that. And it's a really beautiful piece.
So really, just go online and read our stories more. I did want to just touch on, it was a year when people talked a lot about how many people died. Bowie, Prince, Gene Wilder. There were so many.
Fidel Castro.
So many beloved people. Not all beloved, but. But no, for our field, it was like some founding voices, founding parents, founding mothers and fathers, which I think their passing really made us reflect on their legacies and where this movement has been. Zelda Fitchandler being the main one, the founder of Arena Stage in 1950. Gordon Davidson, who was a huge figure in my life because I caught the theater bug in L.A. and he was doing some of his best work when I was there in the 90s, and a real mensch. And Jim Houghton, another great man who founded the Signature Theater, died way too young of stomach cancer this past year. And all of them, you know, we're lucky to have them found the movement that we now take for granted. Jim wasn't a founder. He was maybe the next generation, but he has been carrying the torch forward for playwrights. I really recommend looking at Oscar Eustace's memorial tribute to him, which is, you know, I could tear up just thinking about how significant that exchange was. We don't have a lot of time now to talk about the coming year. Well, should we maybe go to Chris Fire? Let's go to Chris Fire interview about neo-futurists now and come back and just look ahead to 2017. How's that sound?
That works for me.
All right.
Yeah.
Here we go. So Chris, how you doing?
Good.
How was the Pigpen show? Did it turn out to be good?
I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Okay.
They've performed here at Writers Theater in Glencoe once before with their show The Old Man and the Old Moon.
Right. That's the one we saw here. Yeah. As well.
Yeah, 3 or 4 years ago, and this is a brand new show. They're premiering Writers. Debated with. They've worked with extensively and who has a long season. It's called The Hunter and the Bear. And it's very style of The Old Man and the Old Moon, but a little bit darker, I would say, a little less whimsical. Still kind of in that sort of folktale vein with, you know, really terrific music. Those guys are some of the most... accomplished musicians, like collectively, that I think I've ever seen create theater. And it's a show about a father whose young son goes missing in the Old West, lumber prospectors, and it turns into a ghost story that's really kind of a nested celebration of like the art of storytelling. It's stories within stories within stories with really terrific music.
That sounds awesome. That sounds awesome. I hope they bring that show here. They created it for Writers specifically.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Yeah, I interviewed them years ago for a piece I did about bands doing musicals. I mean, the Lisps, and I've put Dave Malloy in there and Stu and other folks like that. But anyway, I went out to their place in Queens where they all rented they weren't all living in the same apartment, but it felt like that. It was like a post-college situation, but they're very talented. Look forward to more of their work. But speaking of companies that devise work together, that's a rough segue to the news out of Chicago lately has been about the neo-futurists. And we've been following, as much as we can the story. We haven't written about it ourselves, but you have been. Could you update us on what happened and what the latest is with the neo-futurists?
Yeah, absolutely. So on November 30th, a couple of weeks ago, I received an email, as did several other members of the Chicago Theater Press, from Greg Allen, who's the founder of the neo-futurists and the creator of their flagship show, Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, mm-hmm. which, if you're not familiar with it, is subtitled 30 Plays in 60 Minutes. And it's created by the ensemble, devised by the ensemble. Each, you know, 2-minute play written by a current member. And, you know, the goal of the show is to get through all of that week's 30 plays in the hour before the giant camera timer tells us we've run out of time. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of refreshed every week with new material, again, created by the current ensemble. And so it's one of the most sort of current and reactive pieces of theater, I think, that you can find, in that it has the ability to respond to, you know, news and current events and personal events and political events of that very week that you see the show.
Right. Okay.
Just, you know, not something the theater is always great at.
Right. Right.
And so what happened on the 30th is that Greg Allen sent out this announcement saying that he was, as of December 31st, rescinding or revoking the license that he had provided to the Chicago Ensemble of Neo Futurists to perform Too Much Light.
Hmm. And he's no longer with the company. Is that right? He was, even as of November 30th, he was no longer part of it, right?
That's right.
No, yeah.
He's been not part of the group for about 4 years now, actually.
Okay. All right.
5 years. And the story there is he was actually voted out of the ensemble.
Okay.
And, you know, without getting too much into history, there's, you know, there's some sort of personal conflicts, mm-hmm. and bad blood. And, you know, this was known that there was kind of a rift between Greg and the ongoing company of Neo Futurists in Chicago.
Right.
But the announcement from him, sort of direct to the press, that he was pulling the rights to the show came as, and also not a terrible surprise to the current company. I talked to Kurt Chiang, who's the current artistic director of the Neo Futurists in Chicago, a couple of days after the fact, and, you know, he said that they had been in negotiations for most of this year to renew the 15-year license that they had worked out with Greg back in 2002, and the company thought that they were negotiating in good faith and only were informed of Greg Allen's decision about an hour before he notified the press.
And yeah, I don't want to. Yeah, go on. Yeah.
Yeah. No.
I'll jump in here. So he announced, as I recall, that he was rescinding the rights and then doing. He was going to do his own version of it that was going to respond to the current events. Obviously, we're all thinking about that, about how is theater going to respond, and he was going to do his own. His own version of the show. I mean, not his own version. He was going to take start doing Too Much Light, I guess, with a new ensemble of his own, in the new year. But he didn't rescind the rights for the New York Neo Futurists or the San Francisco group to keep doing it. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. The way that, Greg framed his decision in that announcement was that he was taking the show back to relaunch it, reboot it himself with a brand new ensemble, and that it would be specifically tuned to basically resisting the new presidential administration, and that it would be performed entirely by performers of color or women or LGBT artists, that basically no straight white men, despite Greg being a straight white man
himself. So, right.
And he did say in that initial release as well, his decision to revoke the show from the Chicago company would not affect the ability of the New York Neo Futurists, who have been performing it for about a dozen years, I think, mm-hmm. and the San Francisco Ensemble, which is about 3 years old. The the new development this week is that on Monday, the New York, San Francisco, and Chicago neo-futurist ensembles put out a joint statement saying that all three companies would be working together to create a new flagship show. Mm-hmm. So basically the New York and San Francisco ensembles took that message that, you know, they would still be able to perform Too Much Light at with Greg's permission, and said, thanks, but no thanks.
Right. We'll yeah.
Forward, you know, as a single, you know, single unified force.
So. Right. Okay. So they have to come up with a new title, and I presumably I don't know how much is proprietary about the conception of the show. I guess I have to be careful about that. It's not going to have it's too much baby makes the blind go lighter. So they can't use the same words, I imagine, of the title.
What's generally agreed upon is that Greg Allen owns the trademark to the title Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind and the subtitle 30 Plays in 60 Minutes.
Okay.
There's been some discussion about how much the concept of the show itself can be copyrighted, which to my understanding is that it really, you know, there's the logo that's sort of well known. There's the conceit of the camera timer and the clothesline with numbers for all the pieces that are on the menu for each evening. But you know, each of the philosophy as Kurt Chiang explained it to me, that they've worked under, the New Futurists and Greg Allen have worked under for years and years, is that each individual piece, each play within Too Much Light, is retained, the copyright is retained by the individual writers.
Oh, okay.
So none of the actual material that's been performed in Too Much Light over the last 28 years in Chicago is owned by Greg Allen, except for the pieces that he wrote himself.
Interesting. I didn't know about that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to see, you know, how much claim he can actually make to, you know, being able to prevent any of the ensembles from going forward with the same basic concept as long as they rebrand under a new name.
So we should be clear. The New Futurists, that's their flagship show, but they do other shows. They have a season. They do plays. They do other late night shows, right? This isn't the only thing, although they're best known for this.
They're absolutely best known for this, but yeah, they do a full primetime season every year of, I believe, four shows that are all sort of created under the same the New Futurist aesthetic,
right,
of you know, performers performing as themselves, not as characters, it all being sort of stylized nonfiction,
right?
And yeah, the primetime shows are very successful as well. But, you know, it's the late night lining up for Too Much Light that is kind of the iconic image of the New Futurist. But, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with people about this over the last couple of weeks, of course. And I'm of the opinion that those people are going to continue showing up at 11:30 on Friday and Saturday night and lining up outside the New Futurarium. No matter what the show they're lining up to see is called, they know the experience.
Right. Okay. And you think they'll also do that if Greg comes out with whatever his show? Oh, well, we know his show will be called Too Much Light.
Yeah. What we don't know is where it's going to be performed or right, who's going to be in it. He said that he wants to make it sort of a traveling show,
okay,
so you know, can be performed in venues and in neighborhoods that are less well served by theater in Chicago, which is admirable enough. I mean, there's certainly plenty of neighborhoods that are theater deserts in the city.
Right.
But you know, it remains to be seen who he'll be able to recruit, when exactly it will launch, what it'll look like, and you know, what kind of infrastructure he'll be able to rebuild to support the show.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the last question I want to ask is, have you followed the new, how often has your theater going diet? Have you checked in with the Too Much Light show? Has it? Is it something you feel like could use a like a reboot or a refresher? Or is it kind of self-rebooting because this concept is always so fresh?
I think self-rebooting is exactly right, because right. not only is the concept itself sort of require it to be infused with fresh material every week, but the ensemble refreshes pretty regularly.
Okay.
You know, it's not as though it's not as though you can go to Too Much Light and see the same performers that you would have seen doing it 10 years ago, okay. still just kind of like cranking stuff out. They have a mechanism in place. They have a training program in place, really, for the neo-futurist aesthetic, and they're constantly recruiting new performers and putting them into the show. You know, my experience of the show, which I go back and see, you know, every once in a while, and you know, I'm always kind of hyper aware of who's in the show and what they're talking about week to week. I think it's disingenuous at best to suggest that the current ensemble was not already addressing the political climate, or that they were not diverse enough to be able to address that kind of thing. It's as I said, it's one of the sort of sharpest shows around in its ability to always be taking on exactly what's going on in the world, like the moment that you're seeing it.
Right. So you going forward, it sounds like we'll be talking about the show, whatever it's called, and you'll have to figure out whatever they call it to write about it as if it was formerly known as the artist formerly known as Too Much Light Goes Big, Baby Goes Blind. Interesting. I don't know. The final question would be about the takeaway that this is a personal dispute. I guess it's some more than a real artistic division. It certainly felt that way when he let the rights continue in the other cities, but not in his home, in his backyard. I mean, you could interpret that as like, well, he wants to not have the waters muddied in his own backyard. That's where he's going to be doing it. So of course he has to pull it from them. But it felt a little bit like, you know, if it's really about the show artistically, why would he let the other troops do it? And I guess that's what their response tells us, is that, you know, it's really a story about Greg Allen versus the neo-futurist in a way, right?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to read it any other way than that.
Yeah, yeah. But you'll cover both their work in the future, I'm sure, as a theater critic, and call it like you see it.
Absolutely.
Sounds good. Chris, it's great to talk to you, and I hope you have a great holiday there in Chicago.
Thank you as well. Yeah, thanks.
All right. Okay, bye now.
Bye.
And we're back with a look ahead at 2017. It's right around the corner. Susie.
Oh, I said I got something all the way off the air, so now I got to go first.
You got to go first, yeah. Of course.
That's what happens when you say it.
Like, I don't know if this is going to happen exactly in 2017, so maybe it's more of a hope for the future, but I really loved the movie La La Land, which is getting a lot of movie press and awards chatter, and I would like to see there be more movie musicals in that vein.
All right.
Coming forward, I think, you know, it's we've seen a resurgence with our, like we're talking about our TV issue, and with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend being a musical and talking to Bob Greenblatt, and I think La La Land is kind of reinvigorating the conversation around film musicals, and I would like to see Hollywood carry up the torch on the form and keep it going. Make more.
I would like to see them improve the live musicals, because
I thought
Hairspray was really good. No, I didn't watch it.
I heard it was uneven.
Okay.
And right. I've never liked Hairspray to begin with, and so it wasn't surprising. But like, I really liked Grease, and that was surprising because
Grease
was
amazing.
Yeah. So more like Grease, less like Peter Pan live.
No, but I'm not talking about like live TV. I'm talking about like cinema big musicals.
Singing in the Rain.
Original musicals?
Sure, original musicals.
That's what
musicals.
I want to see. I don't want to see adaptations of
I don't want to see like another Sound of Music movie. Suck. I want to see like La La Land's original.
Except for Hedwig, Cabaret is a short list.
I'd see Hamilton on screen.
Yeah, well,
someday.
Hamilton one day will be.
That's never going to happen.
Film.
It will, but in like 20 years. Wicked will, and it's just going to take a while.
It will.
But I'm not talking about doing stage musical on screen. I'm talking about original movie musicals.
Yeah.
Those are the best kind. Those are the best kind. Deep, so what are you looking forward to in 2000?
Oh, I got
to
think about it. Sorry. Okay. I got to think about it.
Russ, what are you looking forward to or hoping for?
My hope for 2017 is that we get more works of theater like Viet Gone. So more works of theater that explore boundaries and more works of theater that just tell a great story, especially if it involves a marginalized group.
Right. You will get more plays like literally like that because he's going to write more about his family, right? Am I right?
It's going to be a series of plays.
It's going to be a series. Yeah. So like, you
five
know,
plays.
And then one day they can all play in rep and we'll be doddering old people by then, I'm sure, but it'll be wonderful. Allison, what do you look forward to in 2017?
Mine kind of piggybacks on what Russ said. I attended the Fall Forum a couple weeks ago, TCG's Fall Forum in New York City, and a lot of trustees and board members and theater leaders got together on the last day and made a post-it wall, similar to what is now in New York City in the subway system, of their own dreams and goals and how they, in this post-election, aim to bridge gaps between people of different communities at their theater. So I'm just interested to see how people are going to be implementing their action items and what kind of programming is going to happen in 2017.
I want to see plays like Sweat get done more around the country. I mean, just like piggybacking on basically what Russ and Allison said, which is like more stories about people who don't live in New York and who are rich. Because even though The Humans is about like a middle class family who aren't as rich as, you know, like other desert cities, but they're still rich enough that their daughter can afford like a duplex in Chinatown, Manhattan. So it's not like rural poor kind of thing. So I want more works about, you know, people of color, about like poor white people or just like other demographics. And I want that done around the country. And, and if you want to start with something, start off with Sweat, start off with Viet Gone, start off with things that are getting produced right now on a massive scale and have, you know, quote unquote New York approval. And I would like, and you were talking about ticketing actually earlier, Rob. So I would like more theaters embrace that, because I think Oscar Eustis talked about wanting to embrace like lower tickets, which would be great.
Right.
Because whenever I try to pay for theater, and I don't do it very often, it is really not, it's really difficult. And so I think everyone's been skirting around this for like a really long time, like the big institutions, but I feel like it should be embraced on a larger scale. So those are my hopes.
Yeah, I don't want to necessarily take the last word, but I will say the last word on this. The post-election colloquy where we asked artistic directors and playwrights how they would respond to this moment, this political moment that we're in, and how they plan to, how they would like to shape the conversation. I mean, we have to recognize the gift that we have of a platform to address these things. I'm saying both here at American Theater, but also on our stages. And he talked about radical solidarity with each other. And I would just expand that to say radical accessibility. I kind of feel like we can debate a lot about what kind of plays should be done. I think we all know that we'd like to see more diverse stories and more diverse casts on stage. I would like to just also talk about what, no matter what shows we're doing, who's coming, who's invited into the room, both to make the work, but also to see the work.
Oh,
and
definitely.
I think that has a lot to do with ticket prices, but prices, money aside, it's like about mission. What are the theaters for? One thing that came through really strongly also in that colloquy was theaters all over the country, from, you know, Missouri to, you know, North Carolina to New York, Seattle, whatever. They are looking anew at what it means to gather people together in this time. And looking at what those people look like, are they just very few people of color and they're, you know, a ring of white people, or is it and socioeconomically as well? I'm hopeful because that theaters are moving in this direction, thinking about this, and it's certainly a big focus of TCG. I just think now more than ever is a time to double down on those commitments. And, you know, again, with whatever kind of work, I think the content of it, the content of the work is one thing, and we're always focused on that. But I think the context, again, even if you're doing Christmas Carol, if you're doing TYA, who is in the room and what kind of people are being allowed to have that privilege to be around theater and be part of theater that we all enjoy.
That's why they should make ticket prices cheaper so more people can come in.
Yeah, sure. Subsidize them. Yeah. I think on that sounds like a somber note to end on. I think we're all about to head off to some fun holiday times, right? We wish you all the best for the holidays. We're not going to do recommendations of things to say. Our recommendation is to relax.
Self-care.
Self-care, family care, try not to argue about politics too much.
Especially to the people in this room.
Yes.
Like, relax, guys. Please do not work over the holidays.
Don't think about the issues we're working on at all.
Yeah. Don't have to tell me twice.
In any case, so it's been another blockbuster year for American Theater and for this podcast. Keep tuning in.
The things that we talked about will be on the show page, links to most of the articles probably. And please rate us on iTunes, review us, and we'll see you in 2017.
See you at the theater.